Welcome to episode number 11 of Tech Talk Today on WCCR 94.5 LPFM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberlands in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. As always, we enjoy tweets to at WCCR Tech Talk during the show with your comments and ideas. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's Tech Roundup. This is a pretty long one. DARPA wants to kill the password. Many security experts agree that our current authentication system, in which end users are forced to remember passwords or more often write down a dizzying array of these passwords and usernames, is broken. DARPA, the U.S. Defense Department research arm that developed the internet, is trying to work past the problem by eliminating passwords altogether, replacing them with biometric and other cues using off-the-shelf technology available today. I went through this a little quick. I mean, there's a whole lot here, but some I've never even heard of. So this is very interesting. Of course, we've all heard of eye scans, retina patterns, fingerprints, voice analysis, and even I've heard of brainwave scans. But there's a few other ones I hadn't heard of. Micro hand movements, a project underway in New York Institute of Technology, aims to analyze micro movements and oscillations in your hand as you hold a smartphone to determine the identity of the user. It is looking at touch burst activity, which happens when a user performs a series of touch strokes and gestures. The pause between those touches and gestures helps identify a person. Activity-based analysis, trying to exploit accelerometers and gyro sensors already inside smartphones to extract unique and distinguishing characteristics, the way a user walks and stands. Your stride length, the way you balance your body, the speed you walk, are all individual to you. That's very interesting. Stylometry. The differences in how we use language could be enough to tell us apart. Drexel University is trying to extract author fingerprints from the large volumes of text we typically enter into our PCs and smartphones, and then use that to spot when someone else might be at the keyboard. Now, that's kind of interesting, too, because, I mean, you have to be using your computer, but you have to log onto it first, so, I mean, but...
Activity-based analysis, I could just see the guys sitting there at the desk, and they're like, oh, yeah, here comes that guy that walks like Cro-Magnon Man.
Microwave heartbeats. Please keep all questions to the end of the discussion. Microwave heartbeats. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory is trying to detect the individual features of your heartbeat from a phone. Microwave signals emitted by the phone are reflected back by your body, collected by sensors in the phone, and amplified to detect your heart rhythm. This might have the added bonus of being able to alert you to see a doctor should a subtle change in your heartbeat happen. Continuing on, system anomalies. Last thing anyone wants to see on a PC is an error message, but this particular type of annoyance might turn out to have a role to play in security. By throwing up random error messages and analyzing how users respond to them, the Southwest Research Institute is hoping to identify individuals and spot intruders. So next time your PC tells you it's out of memory, as you want to report the issue, think carefully. It could be testing you. I could talk about this one for days. Biometric analysis. Most familiar with fingerprint sensors. We'll skip some of that because that's pretty much visual fingerprinting. Visual streams to make sure you're the one using your PC or your phone. There's some of these I've never heard of.
Most of these I've never heard of, and I mean, they're interesting. I mean, they're all ways to identify a person.
Mm-hmm.
I just wonder, you know, I mean, the thing you got to look at when you do any type of different type of authentication is false positives.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, if there can, for instance, this micro hand movement, I mean, how many people in the world have the same micro hand movements? And I've never heard of micro hand movements until 30 seconds ago. but I mean, how many people in the world have the same thing? Maybe, and I haven't done any research on this, but maybe, it's one in a couple of million. Well, you know, or maybe it's one in 200. You know, if there's going to be a lot of false positives,
is that enough to
right? I mean, you don't want to identify someone as credentialed when they're not.
Right. One very interesting thing: when I use a phone, if I'm angry, I'm probably going to be more jerky with the movements that I, you know, I mean, how can emotion affect your micro hand movements? I don't know if I mean, like I said, if I'm angry, I'm going to probably have more tears, texts or whatever.
You're
another one.
You're going to have macro hand movements as you throw the phone. Right.
That's, I mean, there's some cool stuff here. And working in the IT, into IT field to see, you know, what's going to happen, what's going to change. Will desktops and laptops ship with more alternative security features? I mean, I've heard of picture passwords where you touch different parts of the picture and do different gestures to unlock the surface. There's a way to do that on that.
Well, they've been doing that on Android for several years now, where you do the swipe. You make a gesture type swipe on your screen, and mm-hmm. that is your unlock passcode. You know, obviously, iPhone came out with the Touch ID. Where you touch it with one of your fingers, you can put up to five fingerprints in there. That's just a different type of authentication. But I couldn't agree more with DARPA that passwords are very insecure. Now I don't agree with them wanting to eliminate passwords. I think you should have multiple forms of authentication.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a password that you input plus, you know, maybe a thumbprint or, you know, a retina scan or a micro hand movement scan, but multiple options for authentication that have to be done in order to authenticate you fully.
Oh, yeah. And that's another thing. You know, we keep adding more layers and people are going to figure out ways to break them down. I mean, what was it? Hours after the iPhone 5S was released, some guy used wood glue and broke the fingerprint scan.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, anything can be broken. It's just a matter of how difficult it is and how much effort the cracker will need to put into it.
You just like saying cracker.
Cracker.
Engadget article about unlocking cell phones. Now that the phone unlockers have been given the governmental green light, T-Mobile is trying to make the very process of unlocking less of a hassle, although very slowly. The magenta-hued carrier has created a device unlock app that'll let you either temporarily unshackle your phone for 30 days or do the deed permanently. Now, you might say, why would I want to unshackle my phone or unlock my phone for 30 days? Well, maybe you're traveling overseas and you want to put a different card in it or whatever. You are still bound by T-Mobile's eligibility requirements if you try permanently unlocking your device, and the app only works with Samsung's decidedly mid-range Galaxy Advent, on which the app comes preloaded right now. The folks at Android Central, not Android Police, sorry, Kurt, couldn't help but sideload the app onto a few other devices, but they didn't have much luck freeing any of them from T-Mobile's grip. So here's to hoping that T-Mobile will add this on some more devices. It looks like they've tried to look like they're making it easy, but in the end, it's not easy.
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction, at least. They're seeing that there's a need for it and at least making strides to go that way, in my opinion. But,
well, yeah, that's true. I agree with that. I mean, that is good for them. I mean, I haven't seen anything about AT&T or...
Well, that might get a lot of people to switch, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it needs to be done if you're going to be a good business. You know, follow along with the new rules and help your customers out.
Gotcha. Is the Microsoft Surface drowning? I'm just going to be honest. I'm a fan of the Microsoft Surface. After I used one, I really thought, you know, I enjoy this. This is a lot of fun to use. I can actually do some work on this. It pains me to see when things aren't going well, but this apparently it has an upside to it. So not much good news for the Microsoft Surface. Computer World reports Microsoft's losses on the tablet device at $1.7 billion so far. But still, Microsoft is serene. It is exciting to see the response to the Surface Pro 3 from individuals and businesses alike. In fact, Surface Pro 3 sales are already outpacing prior versions of Microsoft Pro. The Surface business generated more than $2 billion in revenue for the fiscal year 2014 and $409 million in revenue for quarter four. What does that stand for?
Fiscal year 14.
Fiscal year 14 alone. I've learned something today. The latter of which included just 10 days of Intel Core i5 Surface Pro 3 sales in Canada and the U.S. Should Microsoft pull the plug on the tablet, or maybe it's just a matter of users getting used to the Surface? Even if they're losing money on the Surface Pro 3, Microsoft is seemingly little to be ashamed of when it comes to reviews of the hardware, which have usually been overwhelmingly positive for Pro 3. Like I've said in a previous episode, you know, that's Microsoft's way of getting into a market. They'll sell something at a loss, get it in people's hands, somebody's going to buy it. businesses who don't like fully look at, they just look at the end number. They say, hey, we can get this cheaper. People get used to it, then they want it, and they'll start paying more for newer versions that come out. So, you know, good for them.
Yeah, I mean, I have a Surface that I've used, and
like twice.
It's an RT. Yeah, like once. I use it more than once. Okay, you know, I've said this before on this show. All this stuff is like a tool, okay? I mean, I got a toolbox out my truck, and I've got a Phillips screwdriver and a flathead screwdriver and a hammer and a wrench. And you know, that's the Surface, and that's the iPad, and that's the laptop. All these things are different tools to use at different times. And so, you know, one thing that I may use my Surface for, I might not use my iPad for, and vice versa. So, you know, I hope that the Pro 3 turns out good for Microsoft. I haven't held one or worked on one personally yet, but looking forward to seeing one. And I'm looking forward to seeing how things are going to work out for them with the NFL deal.
Oh yeah,
with the Surfaces, I think that will be quite interesting.
Oh yeah, I mean, like, there's another. This would be a good joke from about more about Surface news on a little later, but yeah, you know, I guess we're all about Microsoft today.
All about Microsoft. Engadget article from talking about Windows Mobile. The Windows Mobile app catalog may not be as extensive as what you'll find on Android or iOS, but, and Kurt's shaking his head,
nodding.
or nodding, yes, yeah, not shaking his head, nodding, sorry, the other direction. But you won't be hurting for choices anytime soon. Microsoft has quietly revealed that the Windows Phone Store racked up over 300,000 apps as of this past June, or nearly twice what it had a year earlier. Had 200,000 apps in December, so the rate is clearly accelerating. Half of its library appeared in the past several months. There are also 50% more developers, which means that many of the new titles are from first-timers. The expansion will definitely help if you're considering a Windows phone, especially since it includes big-name titles like Instagram and Vine. With that said, there's still a long way to go before Microsoft fills in all the gaps.
Yeah.
You know, Kurt, I haven't ever really asked you this, but here's my question. You know, I've noticed that on the Surface with the apps that, okay, you know, like for instance, and this isn't the case anymore, Facebook finally came out for an app for the Surface.
Mm-hmm.
But for the longest time, they didn't have one.
Took a while.
And there were people out there that were writing apps for it. And essentially what it did was pull up the web page. But one of the first things I do when I look for an app is I actually type in the name of the company.
Yeah.
And I want an app developer from that company. I want them to develop.
From the developer, yeah.
Right.
I could tell you some interesting things on this one. Basically, obviously, in the hierarchy of phones, you know, you've got, what, iPhone and Android, 1 and 2. You know, whatever order you want to put them in, they are 1 and 2. And then you could say Windows Phone is 3. You could say probably, I don't know, include RIM as 3 with BlackBerry. But, you know, you got to get the first two covered and then move on to the other markets. And then for some businesses, it may not be worth it to move into the Windows Phone market. That said, let's take, for instance, YouTube app. Google wrote a YouTube app for iPhone. Google has a YouTube app for, at least I don't know if they'd still do that with Android. I assume they do. Google did not write a YouTube app for Windows Phone. Didn't make one for the longest time. Still, as far as I know, still do not. Microsoft wrote a YouTube app for it. It included the ability to download videos and the blocked ads. Google said, take this off there now, because they you have to have this off. You take this out of your app store. You take off download and take off this. So they said, no, we're going to block this entirely, and they blocked the app from the Windows Phone. Microsoft complied, made another attempt at the YouTube app, and Google blocked that again. They said, no, this isn't comply with our terms of use, whatever. We're going to block this too. Repeatedly, the Microsoft team has tried to develop a YouTube app. Google continues to block them from it, from doing this, for whatever reason. To me, that sounds like not antitrust. That sounds like some kind of violation, to be completely honest, to continually be blocking. They could probably sue them for this. Of course, you know, big corporations, they sue all the time. But there's some instances where I think people are trying to actively block Microsoft from having a successful device, to be completely honest. Of course, it could be just me trying to root for the underdog. But
so why do you think that Google doesn't create a YouTube app for the Surface themselves?
No. Even Surface, I don't know. Either they don't see them as a threat, or they see them as a very big threat and don't even want to even have them attempt to.
Well, we were talking about the phone, for the phone. So there is no, and again, I'm kind of out in the dark when it comes to the Windows phone, because I don't have one. I haven't really played one. So there is no YouTube app.
No official YouTube app. There's tons of third-party ones, or where,
Microsoft attempted to create one.
They created a fantastic one. It blocked ads, and you could even download the video, which would be fantastic and was great for a little while. But they had to pull it from the store because Google made them pull it from the store. I mean, I see that as very underhanded business. I mean, I understand you can do whatever you can, and this hands-off kind of business, that's what's going to happen. But it's kind of frustrating for the end users like myself who would like to use an official YouTube app and be able to see playlists and everything. And it was even created, but...
Well, obviously, we know, and our listeners realize that, the biggest thing with your mobile device, whether you have an Android device or you have an Apple device or you have a Microsoft device, the biggest thing is the App Store. I mean, if you don't have any apps on your iPhone, then you essentially have a cell phone. You have a flip, a pretty flip phone, paperweight. I mean, you're if you're not
feature phone, I guess you
could feature
even say.
Phone. Yeah, I mean, you're not, and if you don't use the features of the iPhone, the apps that are included like mail and those kind of things, and all you got's just a regular phone,
right?
So I mean, really, the apps that are developed for each of those devices is really where it's at, and I don't know. Maybe that's part of it. Maybe Google wants people to use Android more than they want them to use Microsoft phone, Windows phone. And they, don't want to have that YouTube app out there. I don't know. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about it, but it's interesting.
Yeah. And I haven't looked at the news in this a long time. There could be a lot of developments, but I was like, oh, cool, YouTube app. I downloaded it. It worked great. And then all of a sudden it disappeared and stopped working. So kind of frustrating.
Be something interesting to look into to see where they're at on that. But that's the information from Microsoft lately on their app catalog. It's good for them.
Yeah, very good. Internet infrastructure. Google is backing a new 300 million high-speed internet trans-Pacific cable. Google's announced it is backing plans to build and operate this cable system called FASTER. Don't know if that stands anything for anything or not, but in addition to Google, the $300 million project will be jointly managed by China Mobile International, China Telecom, Global Transit, KDDI, and Singtel, with NEC as the system supplier. FASTER will feature the latest high-quality 6-fiber pair cable and optical transmission technologies. The initial design capacity is expected to be 60 terabits per second, or 100 gigabits per second times 100 wavelengths times 6-fiber pairs, connecting the U.S. with 2 locations in Japan. I did read that right?
Yes. It made me look up when I heard
it's a capital
said.
T and a lowercase v.
Yes.
So just for our listeners, if you see a capital B after like a capital G, that's gigabyte, and a lowercase b after a capital G would be gigabit, and this is terabit. So
that's a lot of data.
that's a lot. That's really, 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 really fast.
So this is going to be trans-Pacific. So this isn't transit. This is from U.S. to Japan.
Yeah, this adds a second location in Japan, I believe.
Nice.
Unless there's already a I'd have to look and see. I know there's at least one connection going to the Pacific through the Pacific from the United States. So that's impressive.
That is impressive. So
I guess we should explain a little bit for you, our normal listeners. There are a series of undersea cables that connect the continents together. Not every single continent, but United States, one goes to Europe. At least one goes to Europe. At least one goes across the Pacific to Japan. And so those are the backbones of the internet in terms of going between continents. And though a lot of traffic, if you're going to, say, Google, there's probably multiple servers all across the world, but if you connect to something that's hosted overseas, then that's where that data goes through, and this will make that certainly a lot faster.
And, fiber runs through well, light runs through fiber. So it's a laser light that runs through this fiber connection. And that's the reason it can travel such more of a long distance than electrical pulse over copper. And, you know, the great thing about fiber is with copper, obviously, you can have interference.
Electromagnetic.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you take a magnet and you stick it up against a copper Ethernet cable, and you're gonna create some traffic problems there. But with fiber, it's light, and the only way that you can create a traffic problem with it is to either bend it enough to break it or cut it. And so, you know, this is exciting. I mean, I'm glad that Google's getting into something like this. And obviously, the more data that goes from, you know, continent to continent, the more that we're going to need to rely on faster transmission speeds because of the amount of bandwidth that we're pushing. And so this is nothing but good.
Would you dare say this would help alleviate traffic across other parts of the world because it might be taking shorter distances? I'd have to know more. I said,
yeah, I mean, if it can help traffic route better and take less hops, you know, I think we may have talked about this last week, but when you go to a website, you're going from, you know, from router to router to router and hopping from router to router as you get to that server on the other end. So let's say, for instance, that you go to, you know, sitename.com, and that site is in Washington State. Maybe it's somewhere in Washington State. Then if you're here in Kentucky, then you're going to hop from router to router to router and to get to that location. More than likely, you're going to route through some large city like Atlanta. If you're on the AT&T network, you're probably most definitely going to go through Atlanta or Indianapolis, and then you're going to route all the way over to Washington. And, you know, each one of those stops that you make at a router is called a hop. And so if you were to run a command and you were to run a command on your PC called a traceroute command, it looks like tracert, but tracer. It's called traceroute, T-R-A-C-E-R-T. And if you run that command, you would be able to see each hop as it goes there and the IP address of the router that you're hopping on. So, you know, yes, theoretically, this could help with traffic if it provides fewer hops to a location overseas and on a different continent. So that's, you know, pretty cool stuff.
All right.
Network World article, a number of aspiring attorneys have filed lawsuits seeking class action status and millions of dollars in damages against software maker ExamSoft after a series of technical problems last week temporarily prevented them from uploading their completed bar examinations.
Ooh.
Court records show that at least three suits have been filed against bar exam software vendor this week following widespread outcry from test takers on social media and law-related websites who railed against ExamSoft for making their lives just that much harder on an already stressful day. ExamSoft's wholly insufficient infrastructure suffered from a total collapse on examination day, according to one of the lawsuits, which was filed on behalf of a test taker, Philip Litchfield, in the U.S. District Court, Northern District of Illinois. The company, quote, knew well in advance of exam day exactly how many applicants had registered and paid to use the soft test program, end quote, and should have made the necessary preparations to handle it. That's what the lawsuit stated there. Some applicants weren't able to upload their tests until the second day of the bar exam, while others weren't able to make their state's submission deadline, although most states ended up extending it by a day. ExamSoft's failure caused them, quote, significant emotional distress, end quote. I knew that had to be in there somewhere. Amounting to more than $5 million in damages, ExamSoft did not respond to requests for comment on the story.
Wait, you know what the best part is? They can't really go through the suit because they didn't turn in their bar exams.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I mean, who is the worst? I mean, these would be the worst people to make mad because, I mean, these are people who know how to file their own lawsuit and, like, represent themselves in the suit as well. So,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing about online systems like that is, you know, you got to have all kinds of redundancy in place because if it goes down, I mean, you got a lot of people out there who are, you know, essentially just sitting there twiddling their thumbs waiting for you to get it back up and running.
So much of our lives depend on it now. I mean, or I should say our daily lives. I mean, it's, how much online business does, you know, each business need now? Almost every business has an online presence, almost. You know, I'm sure there are plenty out there that do not and are still successful, but I've not heard of them.
Well, I mean, you know, it's hard for people to find you. I mean, I don't know about you, but along those same lines, it doesn't really have anything to do with this article. But, you know, when I was telling somebody this the other day, I'd actually a few years ago, I'd helped to create a website for a local business owner. And, you know, they were contemplating not renewing the website. And I said, you know, well, you know, why not? And, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I mean, I help them with it. I don't make any money off of it. And I said, you know, why not? And the person said, they said, well, they said, you know, we're not really seeing any requests come in from our email form. And I said, well, I said, okay. I said, but how do you know that? I said, okay, me, for instance, if I want to find a service, a good or a service here in my local area, I don't have a Yellow Pages at home. When they come to my and throw them out in my driveway like they normally do, I take it and I throw it in the trash can because I don't use it. Yeah, it's, you know, or I use it to burn wood piles with or something, you know, start the fire with. I don't use it. I go online and I do my research and I look and see what other people have commented about it. And I look for them to have a website. If they don't have a website, then typically they're not at the top of my list. And then I go from there. And I said, okay, I said, how do you know that these people that you're getting calls from didn't go to your website first? Do you do a survey of the person that says, how did you find us? They said, well, no, we don't do that. And I said, well, if I had my guess, a whole lot of the phone calls that you're getting are from people like me going online and typing in this type of business.
Finding the telephone number.
Finding the telephone number and calling you. I said, because that's what I do. And I think that's what a lot of people, you know, in our generation do.
Yeah.
And I think even people in the generation before us, and definitely people in the generation after us, but people in the generation before us are beginning to do that as well. Because people from our generation are teaching them, hey, you can save money.
There's an easier way.
Yeah, you can save money by going out online and looking at these different goods and services. I have no idea how we got there from talking about a bar exam. But anyway, that was my 2 cents after the bar exam. That must not have been very interesting. I had to add something to it.
I understand you. Hackers demand automakers get serious about security. Automotive, this is in automotive news, obviously. In an open letter to automotive CEOs, a group of security researchers called an automotive industry executives to implement 5 security programs to improve car safety and build cybersecurity safeguards inside the software systems powering various features in modern cars. As car automation systems become more sophisticated, i.e. more dependent on computers, they need to be locked down to prevent tampering or unauthorized access. The 5-star automotive cyber safety program, outlined in the letter asked industry executives for safety by design, third-party collaboration, evidence capture, security updates, and segmentation and isolation. Vehicles are computers on wheels, said Josh Corman, CTO of Sonatype and co-founder of I Am the Calvary, the group who penned the letter. The group aims to bring security researchers together with representatives from non-security fields such as home automation and consumer electronics, medical devices, transportation, and critical infrastructure to improve security. That's kind of scary stuff. I mean, they said one of the last devices in your car to become truly electronic was the brakes. And I've heard a guy who works on cars said, you know, that's scary to him, that if I hit the brakes, it's going through basically, well, I shouldn't say fly-by-wire, but it's going through a computer to be calculated first. And, you know, what if that computer fails? Is there a hydraulic safeguard? Is there some sort of, I can't think of the right word here, but a fallback, a fail-safe in case the computer's not working, you know?
Right. Does it work like air brakes on a bus where when you run out of air, they lock up? I mean, that's where
fail secure.
Yeah, so they fail secure exactly.
I don't know
the answer to that.
That's what's going to happen next. Obviously, we had malware on our computers, and now we're going to be getting malware on our phones. Now we're going to get malware on our cars.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, they've already shown how They can take and be in a car and plugged into the I don't know what the port's called, but the computer port on your car. It's the port that you, I don't know what it's called, but anyway, it's the port that you, it's an OBCI maybe port.
Is it a diagnostics port?
Diagnostics port, and they could plug in there and completely take over your car. I mean, the car that the guy was in, the video I watched.
OBD, onboard diagnostics.
Yeah, OBD, there we go. And he could, it was one of those cars that would park itself, you know, would turn the steering wheel. He could turn the steering wheel for the guy. He could hit the brakes.
Oh, that's
awesome. He could make the car think that it was in an impact and jerk the guy's seatbelt. He could do all that stuff from sitting in the back, and he was plugged in. Now, we haven't talked about this yet, I don't think, but there's a new application out there, and it's called Automatic. And Automatic is a little Bluetooth-enabled device that plugs into your OBD
onboard diagnostics
port, and that communicates wirelessly via Bluetooth with your iPhone.
And do whatever.
And it what it's designed to do is show you diagnostics information, show you, okay, don't punch your gas so hard when you pull out. You'll save some fuel that way.
Jailbreak your phone. You've got access to everything.
Well, I mean, I would assume so. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting. The more computers are in the car, like you said, you know, the more that the car is hackable.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, there's so many implications to this. I mean, you could stop someone's car and say, wire me $200 and unlock your car. You may not even do it, but, you know, you've ran somewhere on your car.
Well, I mean, you think about it. There's lots of good applications for this. For instance, law enforcement. You have somebody speeding down the road, pull up beside them, push a button, and shut the daggum thing off. Hit the brakes as hard as they can be hit. Push out the airbags and, you know, deploy the airbags, hit the brakes, and, you know, make sure there's no other cars around and let the thing come to a stop. You know, and you've got a person in the vehicle that you're trying to apprehend who's just been hit by air brakes and went through a, you know, G-force stop. Good for them. You know, I think that has good implications. Whether or not the police would want to use it or not, that's a different story. But, you know, if that can be done, and I'm not saying it can be, I've never heard of anything like that, but I'm just throwing out an idea.
Right.
If that can be done, then someone else could do it maliciously.
Right. I mean, will chop shops become some sort of a weird hacking shop? You know, I mean, there's all kinds of implications here.
I was waiting for you to say cracker. Network World article about emergency text. Before Kurt says that again, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission voted Friday to require U.S. mobile carriers and many text messaging apps to enable users to text emergency dispatch centers, even after questions about whether the centers will be ready by the deadline. Now, the commission's vote requires U.S. mobile carriers and some texting apps to put emergency text to 911 functionality in place by the end of the year. So even though the nation's four largest mobile carriers have all added text to 911 functionality this year, less than 2% of the nation's 6,800 emergency dispatch centers are ready to receive texts. The commission's action will give smartphone users the impression that they can send texts to emergency responders, when many will not be able to even do that because their actual location, their regional emergency response location, doesn't have that ability. Mm. The FCC's action, quote, encourages the public to dive into text to 911 functionality when in reality there's hardly any water in the pool, end quote. That was a quote by Ajit Pai. He's the commissioner there for Federal Communications Commission. And it says here, the order is sure to result in massive consumer confusion and therefore will endanger rather than advance public safety. Now, FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler, which we've heard a lot about lately, applauded the largest mobile carriers, Verizon, AT&T, Sprint, and T-Mobile, for adding text to 911 functionality. He said that the agency needs to push other carriers and emergency dispatch centers called public safety answering points, or PSAPs, to do the same. I mean, I think this is a great idea to be able to text an emergency center. Example, you're in your home and someone breaks in your home and
you're hiding
and you don't want to pick up the phone and be like, You don't want to hear 911. How can I help you? Hey, yeah, there's some guy in my house, and
there he is. Yeah, in the closet.
Do you want to talk to him? You know, it'd be a lot easier to to send a quiet text and to hide somewhere and be extremely quiet. And you know, your life is never more important than the TV that the guy steals.
Right.
So you know, go hide and.
Which then they send a text back, he's over here.
So, you know, I mean, it's I think it's a great idea. But I do agree with the commissioner, though, that, you know, everybody needs to be on board at the same time. You can't have all these, you can't have the FCC going, okay, this is great, let's
partial adoption.
And nobody ready to receive the text.
Right.
Because, I mean, that would be horrible if, you know, somebody was in that situation trying to send out texts and nobody responded.
Right.
But text to 911. It's coming.
Yep. So I bashed Google earlier, and now the Chicago mayor praises Google for buying kids Microsoft Surfaces. Google not being like Google. Google earned kudos from Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel this week for teaming up with Staples to fund the projects of 367 of the city's 22,519 public school teachers on beg funding site donorschoose.org. Everything that you ask for, every project that the teachers put on to help their students learn, exceed, and excel here in the city of Chicago. You now have fully funded, Mayor Emanuel said. Chicago's hardworking public school teachers are doing all that they can and more to support their students, but they need some help. Moving on, we jump the chance to join with donorschoose.org and Staples to make Chicago's local classroom wishes come true. So what did Google do but make the possible? Ironically, Google Chicago's giving page shows that the biggest project funded by Google was to outfit a classroom with 32 Microsoft Surface RT tablets for $12,531, or about 6.5 of the $190,091 Google award. Other big ticket projects funded by Google included $5,931 for a personal home biodiesel kit and $5,552 for a marimba. In the middle of the spectrum was $748 for mindfulness education, in addition to similar flash funding projects at Atlanta, paper towels. I didn't read through that article. And the Bay Area. Google and Donors Choose have teamed up this year to reward teachers with $400,000 for recruiting girls to learn to code as part of Google's $50 million Made with Code initiative, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I mean, I would never have figured Google would have purchased. That's why after we said you know, Google is blocking Microsoft from having a YouTube app here.
I know they have a lot of control over. I mean, obviously this was a grant from Google, and I mean, whenever there's a grant, the grantee has a lot of control over what the person can buy. But you know, you got to be careful not to be the grantee that says, "Oh, you can only buy my stuff."
Hmm.
So, question is, does Google really care that they bought a bunch of Surface RTs?
In other news, the Surface RT doubled its
yeah, exactly.
sales.
Well, I mean, if they would have asked nice enough, Microsoft probably would have been like, "Okay, we're trying to get rid of these things here. Just have these." You know, have a write-off.
Yeah, we're trying to get in this market. Please, just take these.
Yeah, just take these. Network World article about credit card chips. There's a push to adopt chip-equipped payment cards in the U.S. following high-profile breaches at large retailers and restaurant chains during the past 12 months. But experts warn that switching to this payment system will not make fraud disappear, obviously. The EMV, Europay, MasterCard, and Visa standard is widely deployed around the world, and for the last 10 years or so it has been the de facto deployment or payment system in Europe, where it's also known as chip and PIN. The cards authenticate at ATMs and payment terminals using a combination of a customer PIN and information stored securely on an integrated circuit. In order to drive EMV option in the U.S., the credit card brands plan to shift liability in October 2015, after which parties that haven't deployed the system will be held liable for fraudulent transactions. Now, that'll get them going. however, the EMV specification suffers from both regulatory and security issues, some of which have already been exploited in real-world attacks, according to Ross Anderson here, engineering professor at Cambridge University. And he had a talk last week at Black Hat. And so you know, I don't know if you have one of these or not, Kurt, but it's a chip, a credit card with a chip in it. And you, like, for instance, our local Williamsburg Walmart, about 3 months ago, installed these chip card readers, and instead of swiping the card down the side, RFID. Like you normally would,
PayWave?
Something like that. It's close. I don't know exactly how the reader works. I think it's metallic. I think it actually touches a metallic chip.
Oh, so it's not like airwaves.
No. You actually have to put it up in there. So it's not like touch and pay.
Oh, I've seen this before.
And
CAC cards, I think, is the...
Right. I mean, it's just got a small chip in it. I mean, most people probably, and what I'm doing right here is I'm actually pulling out one that I have and showing it to Kurt in front of me. But you see here the chip in the top of the card, and that chip contains information on it, and it's called chip and pin. And, you know, used to have to put in a pin number, you know, for like your debit card. Well, this matches a pin number up with your... with the information on the card, and it authenticates that way. And like I said, it's a local Walmart. You just put them up in the bottom of the card reader. But it is more secure than swiping a card. But obviously what they're trying to say is it isn't the de facto secure way of using a card. And obviously that's the case. I mean, it's not going to be the most secure way of doing things.
Is this CAC card?
I mean, I've always heard it called a chip and pin card.
Hmm. Common access. Well, of course, I'm going more of a military. Common access card is what this is known as.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the payment world, they call it a chip and pin.
Interesting.
But anyway, so, but that actually rounds up our tech roundup, and now it's time to talk about app of the week. App of the Week this week is XBMC. I think we talked about it some last week and said we were going to talk about it in App of the Week, so we threw it in there this week. XBMC, that's like X-Ray, Bravo, Mary, Charlie, .org. XBMC is an award-winning, free, and open-source software media player and entertainment hub that can be installed on Linux, OS X, Mac, Windows, iOS, and Android.
And Xbox.
With a hack, featuring a 10-foot user interface. I think what they 10 mean,
foot?
Yeah, that's what it says. I think they're talking about how, you know, you have a 1,000-foot view and a 10-foot view. It's kind of an advanced user interface.
Ooh.
To use with televisions and remote controls. It allows users to play and view most videos, music, podcasts, and other digital media files from local and network storage media and the internet. So I think we talked about this last week. You can take and, you know, please use legal videos that you have access to that are yours, but you can take legal digital copies of videos and store them on a hard drive. You can take legal copies of music that you have and store them on a hard drive, and you can take that, place it on that storage unit, and then play that through XBMC. And if you have a home network set up, you can actually, I've done this at my house, you can set up a database on a central storage unit, and all of your XBMC units can connect back to that central database and play it off of a central storage server. So you can have multiple XBMC instances inside your home that connect back to one storage instance and can play, you know, multiple different things at one time.
That's
you
cool.
You can go from one room to the other and see what you've played and actually
continue from where you left off.
It's really cool. There's all kinds of, you know, features, and if you're more of if you're not tech savvy, you can just do the normal install and just run it. If you are tech savvy, you can set up that additional database and, you know, put it on a local storage or on a centralized storage server and set up several different instances of XBMC, and you can go in and hack the code and put in the name of that database server and have multiple instances of XBMC in your house. It's really kind of cool. I have it at home and I like it.
That's pretty cool. And this is originally grew out of XBMC stood for Xbox Media Center.
That's correct. Yeah.
And what originally was happening is people had original Xboxes. These are the big, giant black ones. And they were they would basically hack it to where they can put their media on it and use it as a media center to connect all these devices, as we've been saying. Well, it's grown out of that, and now you can install on multiple devices. I personally haven't really used it. I did install the XBMC Ubuntu version, and that's a playoff of Ubuntu, where that's a Linux distribution. And I actually don't know. I was going to say what it, that grew out of, but it really doesn't matter. So XBMC Ubuntu is basically all that combined in on, like, if you could put that on an old computer or something or other. And basically works, I would assume, very similarly. I've not seen any other version other than XBMC Ubuntu. So.
And it's really easy to get started. I mean, you can either install this on a laptop that you're already using, so it'll install on Windows or Mac. If you have an old laptop that you're not using and you want to install it on there, then I would suggest doing something like OpenELEC, OpenElec. So OpenElec is a hypervisor base for the XBMC. So you install OpenELEC and it has XBMC inside it, and it's designed to run on older machines or newer machines, but especially it runs really good on older machines.
No, show me that.
One of the cool things is you can actually buy a Raspberry Pi, which is a $35 device you can buy that is designed to teach kids how to code and or how to hack. Not crack, hack. And it's designed to teach them how to do that. And they, you can install OpenELEC or some other small version of XBMC on that device. And it doesn't have any local storage, but you can connect it out to central storage. So pretty cool stuff. XBMC.
Which
is X-Ray Bravo Mary Charlie.
We should probably mention it's renamed now.
Yes.
To Kodi?
Yes.
KODI.
I think that's how it's pronounced, KODI, but it's still going to be at XBMC.org for now.
Bingo. And it'll probably redirect from there even when they do change it. So
I'm sure it will. Go check it out. You know, maybe something fun to use for your house. And that's the app of the week. Now we're going to transition into our deep dive. Starting off our deep dive this week with a Network World article, Microsoft will not, contrary to some expectations, put a name to its next 8.1 Windows update, a decision that not only reflects a scaling back of ambition for reputation-plagued OS, but also indicates a different approach to all Windows releases. On Tuesday, Microsoft said, this is last Tuesday, said that future feature updates, whether new tools or improvements to existing parts of 8.1, would be parceled out under smaller chunks. Here's a quote from Brandon LeBlanc, who is a Microsoft spokesman. He said, rather than waiting for months and bundling together a bunch of improvements into a larger update as we did for the Windows 8.1 update, customers can expect that we'll use our already existing monthly update process to deliver more frequent improvements. Windows 8.1 Update 1, which shipped in April, was a minor upgrade from 8.1 of October 2013. Together, the pair were designed to make the original Windows 8 more palatable to traditional desktop and laptop owners like Justin, who control their desktops with a mouse and a keyboard. Never mind, I'm not going to go there right now. But Windows 8.1 Update 1 will not be followed by Update 2, as many had thought until recently. LeBlanc confirmed, he said in a quote, despite rumors and speculation, we are not planning to deliver Windows 8.1 Update 2. Kurt, what does this mean for Windows 8?
It was a flop, so it didn't work so well. That we can see why is this so? Why you know it, you know, people don't like that much change. You know, the biggest problem I heard from people was no start button. That was the biggest thing. And when you remove the main interface to launch any single thing on your computer, you confuse people. And then they get frustrated, don't want to learn, and they say, oh, I don't ever use this thing. I'm just going to use this iPad here. I may not be able to do my Word documents, but I'm going to use my iPad. You know.
Well, I mean, okay. I understand what Microsoft was trying to do.
Oh, absolutely.
I understand that they were trying to create a unified platform. I mean, that's what they did. Windows Phone, Windows Tablet, Windows 8. It's a unified platform. Across the board, it all looks the same. What's the problem? The problem is that my desktop at home and my monitor at home is not a touchscreen.
I don't need giant icons the size of Texas to click on my email.
Exactly. I mean, I they're not going to give me a cursor the size of Texas. The cursor's still the same. The little mouse cursor's still the same size. Why do I need a tile that's 2x2 to click on?
Oklahoma.
Yeah, I know. I mean, exactly. So, I mean, whenever I first saw Windows 8, I was like, I don't get it. I just don't get it. You know, I haven't used Windows 8 a whole lot. I have used Windows Server 2012 and 2012 R2. I like R2 a whole lot better than 2012 because they got rid of a lot of the weird GUI interface inside of, that was in 2012.
Mm.
I still don't like the idea of the tiles on the start menu, but that's just me.
Let me
what needs to stay and what needs to go, Kurt?
I'll play devil's advocate here for a second. The tile interface, when it made sense to me, was when I thought, okay, imagine you've got, okay, you and I, we're basically power users. We're multiple applications always running. We're switching constantly back and forth. We're working between applications. They're always talking back and forth. Windows 8, think of it with the tile interface for non-power users. Think of somebody who says, they log into their computer, they see one big tile interface says, oh, the email icon has 8 emails next to it. Let's click on that or tap on that. And they're there. That easy. Maybe there's one gesture to switch back to that, and then that's pretty much it. Oh, look, I've got one of my friends had a status update on the People app or whatever. There was a very big, clear number there. Oh, I don't want to see that. I can just hide that, but it's still, still installed there. When I thought that this is mainly made for non-power users, it made a lot more sense. And it basically just used the start screen as a replacement for a start menu. That said, I've gotten used to it. I like the driver support pretty well in Windows 8. It makes little things like, say, changing screen resolutions a little bit cleaner. It's kind of a cool interface, in my opinion, the screen resolutions, but yeah, it's not a big deal. There's little things like that I've gotten used to. That said, I'm a little sad it didn't work well, but typically with Microsoft's track record, they release one poor version of Windows, and then the next one, they get it right. And then they make too many changes, and they release another poor version of Windows, and then they release another one to get it right. That's what's happened with, say, XP. Super solid operating system. I could probably go back further. Then they released Windows Vista. Not a lot of people like that because they released it too quickly. There were people that hardware requirements weren't good enough for it, and it ran too slow because there weren't enough RAM, little things like that.
Had a lot of problems with other programs,
support,
too.
Yeah. Vista was poor. Then they released Windows 7. Again, excellent, very solid, very similar to XP in terms of how solidly it's running. Then they release 8. Not good. 8.1, it's a little improvement, but it's not a whole new architecture, new system. So, we'll see how Windows 9, also codenamed Threshold, will work. So,
I mean, I'm excited about Windows 9. And don't take me wrong. I mean, Windows 8 is an impressive operating system. I mean, I think for Windows to come from where they came, especially with Windows Mobile, WinMo, how horrible that was, and to put Windows 8, kind of across the board on their phones and on their tablets and on their PCs, and it to function even, I think that that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But I think it's a great idea for the phone. I think it's a great idea for the Surface.
Touchscreens.
They have touchscreens. It does not make sense on a non-touchscreen device.
Click and keyboard and click, yeah. Keyboard and mouse. No.
I mean, I agree. If they would have just had a simple, well, this isn't simple, but I mean, if they would have thought about, here's the deal. If this device has a keyboard and mouse, we're doing one thing with our user interface. If this device does not, then we're doing another thing with our interface. I think that would have made the big difference.
I do like that. But let's say I wanted to turn on maybe the touch centric interface on my click and keyboard one. Me being I'm probably more advanced than the typical user. I would be fine with, oh hey, let's see if there's a setting to change that. Other people get it out of the box and say, this is too complicated. It should just work. And they will not, they just don't want to learn. I've had many people that are like that, say, it should just work. It's new. It should have Java installed. It should just work. Why isn't this great a computer? Why doesn't it work?
That's what a wizard's for at the start. I mean, we've detected that you have a keyboard and mouse. Do you want to go into keyboard and mouse mode, or do you want to go into touch mode?
I completely agree with you. But again, someone's going to say, this is too many options for me to get through. I have a new computer out of the box. Why doesn't it work? This is too many options. I agree. I mean, if a computer asks you a question, if something pops up and say, hey, are you sure you want to download this? It looks like it's malware.
Maybe it's a biometric question. Maybe it's an authentication question, Kurt.
That's good.
It depends on how you answer that, whether or not you're going to be authenticated. That's what you told me earlier.
That's a good point. Read. If something pops up with an error, read it first. Typically, if you've got a good programmer on the other end, they've put some thought into this. You know, there's a reason things fail. Things don't just randomly fail. I don't know why I'm getting on this topic now, but yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, no more big updates. Big, you know, 8.whatever update for Windows 8. Looks like they're just going to keep doing little ones, and we're going to wait for Windows 9.
Now I'm upset at end users.
Well, it's getting about 5 till 7 o'clock, and so we're going to jump into our tech in numbers. Today, the stock market for technology was down about 0.3%, and looks like we had a lot of issues with Google today. Google was down almost a full percentage point, down 5 and almost a quarter today, and Apple actually lost a little bit, just 0.2%, but that's unusual for them to go down. So technology market today not doing too great, but not too bad either. It's risen a whole lot over the last few days, and so we're looking for good things in the technology market, and that is tech in numbers. And now here's Kurt's favorite part. Goofy tech.
Okay, let me read this one off. Oh, let's see here. Goofy tech. If I could find my notes here. There we go. The War Kitty. And that's WARKITTEH, Kitte. I'm sure that's internet lingo for you. Security engineer Gene Bransfield has developed War Kitte, a tech-laden collar that turns feline companions into scouts for Wi-Fi hackers. The innocuous-looking accessory hides a Spark Core board that maps wireless networks and their vulnerabilities wherever the pet wanders. If used in the field, the technology would be pretty sneaky. The cat stalking mice in your backyard could represent the prelude to an attack on your wireless router. This is very interesting. Let me see.
Collar that you put around your cat, it has a small processor in it, and has a Spark Core processor, and it essentially has a wireless antenna in it too. So it goes around, and it's essentially war driving. That's why they call it War Kitty. It's war driving around for wireless access points.
Well,
war driving.
What that?
Okay, so
if
I get in my car and I drive around with my phone or my computer and I try to find somebody who has an open wireless access point so I can get on the internet, that's called war driving. So that's what this kitty does. Is this kitty? You put this on your cat, and your Kite goes around and walks around all over the neighborhood and finds, you know, open internet access.
And vulnerabilities.
Yes. And so, you know, if you have a cat and you want to know who around you has open internet, open wireless, you can get a collar for your, and then you can change the name of your cat to War Kite.
There have been websites out there to map where open access points, where open connections are, and there's been talks of lawsuits about this, so this is I guess this could be a slight problem. I mean it's not illegal for me to go around and see if there's an open access point. I want to keep saying access point, open connection, but
yeah,
could it
well,
be?
I mean, you know, if you don't want people to see your open network, then close it.
Put a password on it. It's yeah, like leaving your front door unlocked.
Yeah, encrypt it, like we've said before. So, well, that's going to wrap it up for Tech Talk today. And we thank you for listening to today's show. Don't forget, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/WCCR Tech Talk, and on Twitter at WCCR Tech Talk as well. And don't forget, you can tweet to us right in the middle of the broadcast. Let us know what you think about our topics, and we'll be happy to respond to that on air if we can get that into our time. You can also listen to our podcast of today's show by searching Tech Talk Today on iTunes, or by just going out to our Facebook page and playing it from there. And again, I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Stay tuned for the next couple hours for the tail end of our Super Tuesday lineup for the summer 2014, as we have the Figure Four Fallout with Russell Ridner, Bo Kidd, Casey Malone, Dustin Harden, and Justin Durbin. Thank you all so much for listening. You've been listening to 94.5 WCCR LPFM in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Thank you.